about her relationship with Lois Wilson, but I'm going to mention it because it became very, very important in my life, And she also mentioned that she's been thinking of getting a divorce lately. She told me, as a matter of fact, that the Catholic Church, when it comes to, what do they call those things? An annulment, yeah. That you can get an annulment on the basis of alcoholism. That if your husband's an alcoholic, you can get an annulment. I said, why the hell didn't you tell me that 56 years ago? You know. But anyway, all kidding aside, when you're only known each other 3.5 weeks and you get married, you got to learn a lot about each other over a period of time. So we're just still learning, so to speak. You believe that? Your name is Bill Roop. I had the delight to be... Is Bill here tonight? Oh, there he is, yeah. I had the delight with to be with Bill and Tom, I, and Dave Cook up at Winston-Salem last week. And had a wonderful time with these old guys. You know, Bill is sober, what, 55 years, Bill? Yeah, he's 117. Tom Ivester is sober, what, 55 years? Dave Cook's 54 years? And I'm only sober since April 8th of 1962, and that's 49 years. So I was a baby. I was a baby, you know. Still am, as a matter of fact. I cry a lot. Anyway, I had a wonderful, wonderful time. Wonderful time. And I want to repeat what Bernadette said. This is a beautiful place, and you are beautiful, beautiful people. And I love you all. And those are not just words. I mean it. Because you are what kept me here when I wanted to run. I wanted to run so bad the second time around. I ran the first time around. The second time, because what you were saying to me is you wanted to take my booze away. You know, and you wanted to give me some notes on a damn window sheet, you know, in return, called the steps, you know. And, but I didn't run because there was something about you. It's called unconditional love. And I knew you wanted me to find what you found. And that's what kept me here, the unconditional love that one alcoholic has for another in Alcoholics Anonymous and that every Al-Anon has for another Al-Anon. It's an incredible thing. And it took me so long to come to begin to understand it because I never knew that kind of thing. It wasn't in my home. Might have been in Bernadette's home when you got 16 kids. There's some kind of love going on, you know. You know. She talks about having only one brother. His name was Anthony. He was a great guy. I really loved Anthony, but he was a character, you know. I said to him once, what's it like growing up with all those sisters, you know, in the house with one bathroom? He said, I didn't know until I was 14 I didn't have to sit down to pee. You know, just real character, you know. So I loved Anthony. I still do. And anyway, so this is a wonderful place, and what a privilege, and thank you. Thank you for inviting us to be here and inviting us to celebrate our sobriety with you all. And what a wonderful time to do it, you know, Christmas season. A belated happy Thanksgiving, and I wish you a wonderful, wonderful Christmas season. And Bernadette said I wasn't around much, and then she contradicted herself when she had to admit that we had 9 kids. But I was a newspaper reporter in New York City, and you don't really punch a time clock for that, you know. You never know when you're going to be sent out on a breaking story. In New York City, there's a breaking story every 5 minutes, you know. And it was an exciting time in my life. And I love my wife, but I love what I was doing. Something awful, you know. And when I lost it to this disease of alcoholism, it broke my heart. I loved being a newspaper man. I loved being a journalist in New York. But anyway, I didn't start off that way. I started off as a young man in an alcoholic home who wanted to get out desperately. I hated my life. I used to escape from my life through daydreaming. I was a great daydreamer, you know. My imaginations were so real, I could actually talk to the people I created, you know. I could put myself in places and be there and live the whole situation. This is probably why I finally grew up to be a writer. I mean, I just love getting out of it. And that's what probably kept me going for a long time, being able to do that. And one way I got out of it is I decided, it wasn't just my own decision. I went to a Catholic school, and Sister Mary Teresa thought I had the stuff that makes for priests. She thought I'd be a wonderful priest. She didn't really know me very well. But I was a hero worshiper also. I mean, I loved heroes, you know. And she gave me a book to read called When the Sorghum Was High, and it was about a Maryknoll missionary priest who went to China. He was captured by the Chinese bandits, and they tried to get $1 million out of Maryknoll fathers, and they wouldn't pay, of course, and so they killed him. And I thought, what a wonderful way to die. You know, I figured, you know, because everybody got to think you're a hero, because I had such low self-esteem, I lived on what you thought of me, you know, because I didn't think much of me. But if you thought I was something, then I must be something, you know. And so I went away to the seminary, and all of my aunts thought I was wonderful going away to a seminary. Back in those days, people worshipped seminarians and priests and all that, you know. And but like Bernadette, well, I wasn't dating on weekends. I wasn't, that much of a cheat. I spent 4.5 years playing basketball, football, baseball, very little time, you know, on my religion. And so my spiritual director finally said to me one day, William, I think someday you might make a wonderful father, but not in here. So he suggested I leave. So I wasn't thrown out. It was just a suggestion, right? So I came out of the seminary, and I met Bernadette, and she was going to be a nun, so I got into her habit, and we got married, you know, so. And life began. But by this time, I had found alcohol. I was going to St. John's University in New York. You know, they have a great basketball team. I broke a story. I won't go into details on that, but I broke a story. The fire commissioner of New York who had stolen a lot of money from a lot of construction people in the city of New York. He did it for the mayor. He was the mayor's bag man. Was finally captured, you know, and he was on trial, and he was charged with 99 counts of felony. And one night in my ethics class, I turned around, and there he was. And I thought it was a wonderful story for a man, you know, being on trial for 99 counts of felony, studying ethics at St. John's University. And my city editor thought so, too. So we stopped the presses, and bang, headline story that morning. And that afternoon, he called me over the desk and said, "You got a nose for news, kid. I'm making you a reporter." I was 18 and a half years old, scared to death, wet behind the ears. And he sent me over to Brooklyn Police Headquarters on a lobster shift. That's midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning, which in Brooklyn, New York, is when everything happens anyway, you know. And I said, "What do I do?" And he says, "Go over there, introduce yourself to some of the reporters, and they'll break in. They'll show you the ropes, you know." So I went over, and I never will forget. I walked into the Brooklyn Police Headquarters, and I asked the lieutenant on the desk where I could find some of the other reporters. And he pointed across Flatbush Avenue, which is a big, wide avenue in Brooklyn, to a bar on the corner called the Edison Bar and Grill. He said, "You'll find some of the reporters there in the Edison Bar and Grill." But he was wrong. I found all the reporters in the Edison Bar and Grill. So I went over there and I introduced myself to one of them, Charlie Feeney of the Daily Mirror, believe it or not, the Daily Mirror, which at that time sold for 4 cents. I'm going to really date myself too. Charlie told me what he said. The first thing he said to me is, "What are you drinking, kid?" And I said, "I'll have a Coke." He said, "Hell no." So he bought me a shot and a beer. And I had trouble getting it down, the shot. The beer went down fine. And suddenly he introduced me to George George of the Daily News. And Joey said, what are you drinking, kid? I said, half a Coke. He said, hell no. He bought me a side of beer. What I did not know is they knew I was coming to replace the old guy who was retiring from being a police reporter, a guy named Johnny Crosby, and I was replacing him, and they knew the kid was coming, so they were going to have some fun with me. And so each time I'd meet one of them, and they were passing me down the bar, shot in a beer. By the time I got halfway down the bar, something began to happen. The same thing that happened to you. Remember the first drink? Remember the first few drinks? And that's what happened. I began to feel good. Began to feel comfortable. I began to grow up. I was no longer a scared, uptight 18-year-old kid, you know. And before I left that bar that night, I was a veteran newsman, you know. Loaded to the gills. And I was also an active alcoholic. When I took my inventory, I came to realize I was an alcoholic long before I picked up my first drink. I had all the character defects and shortcomings that we learned about from each other in this fellowship, in this program. You know, I was scared, I was uptight, I was envious, I was jealous, I was greedy, I was all and selfish and self-centered. Everything was revolved around me. And so when I started to drink, I found a new life. It opened up life for me. I mean, I could not literally go out on a dance floor without a few drinks. A few drinks, I became Fred Astaire. With a few drinks, I could ask a girl to go out on a date. And with a few more, I could actually take her on the date, you know. And without knowing it and without even thinking about it, it was never a conscious thing with me. It just happened. I evolved into the life of an active alcoholic. And I thought it was fun, it was exciting, I was able to do things, as I said, that I was not able to do without a drink, and I thought I was a better reporter with a few drinks. With a few drinks, I can go into a detective squad room and interview the detectives about a crime, you know. And that's how the whole thing began, my alcoholism, and how this disease from the very first drink took over my life. And it's really... not amazing, but almost stunning, almost shocking, what we as alcoholics are willing to accept just to have another drink. It's amazing. The things that began to happen to me, in the beginning, they were just small little things. You know, like I was drunk in a bar one night and some girl wanted to learn how to drive a car. So I figured, I'll teach you. So I got in my car, put her on my lap, and next thing I know, we're running into a telephone pole. But it was a big Oldsmobile, so it just dented the front thing, you know. And I don't even remember where she learned to drive that night or not. I mean, I'm sorry. Anyway, but that's the kind of stuff, you know. Then it began to get worse. They called me one night to cover a general alarm fire in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. So I jumped in my car. I was half loaded already. Jumped in my car with a bottle of scotch and six cans of beer and headed for the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And I was driving along Atlantic Avenue in New York where an elevated train runs overhead. An L, you know? I forgot at Bedford Avenue and it went back underground and became a subway train. And I went right into a cement stanchion at 80 miles an hour. Motor landed in my lap, busted six ribs, spit up part of my tongue, fractured my jaw, and came to on the operating table in Jewish Hospital, Brooklyn, and putting me back together again. Those are the kind of things we accept, you know? The upshot of that is, a few weeks later, I was home with Mommy and Daddy to convalesce. And my dad had a bottle. He was an alcoholic. What else would he have? And all of my friends came to see me, and he was passing the bottle. And when he came to me, he grabbed the bottle. I'll never forget. He said, no, Bill. He says, you shouldn't have any of this hard stuff with that wired-up jaw. It wouldn't be good for you. So he handed me a bottle of Christian Brothers Sherry Wine. He said, this will ease the pain. Now, if you clock enough Christian Brothers Sherry Wine through a wired-up jaw, you can get pretty drunk. And it's very sweet, so you can get pretty sick. And if you ever try to throw up through a wired-up jaw, from personal experience, the big pieces come out of your ears, you know? It's terrible, you know? So I did the right thing, and I stopped. I swore off Christian Brothers Sherry Wine, you know? And I continued on. And then, as I say, I met Bernadette, and we got married, and she told you about that. And I met her mother. I didn't particularly care for her mother. Of course, she was always praying, you know. And then later on, I found out that she was praying for me. And I felt like, you know, less of a person, that somebody had to pray for me, you know. And I never forget when we moved into her basement, she'd be sitting at the dining room table. No matter what time I went into that basement, whether it was 8 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock at night or 3 o'clock in the morning, it seemed Mama was always there at the dining room table praying. Because you had to go into the dining room and then down the stairs, you know. And sometimes I'd be so drunk and so mad at her praying, I'd stand there and I'd scream at her, "Stay out of my life. I don't need you in my life. Stop praying." You know what I mean? And Mama would keep praying. Now, when I say praying, I mean, you just didn't know. She had two stacks of prayer cards. She had the New Testament and the Old Testament and two sets of rosary beads. I mean, she prayed. She prayed. You know? But the reason I mention it is, the reason I'm standing here tonight doing this is because Mama did it. Mama prayed me here. Mama prayed me here to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? And I know that. I know that. Anyway, but at this time, it got pretty bad. It got pretty bad. This disease of alcoholism, as we know, and if you knew, I'll tell you, it affects every single aspect of our lives. It doesn't distinguish whether we're white, whether we're black, whether we're skinny, whether we're fat, whether we're Jewish, whether we're Protestant. It doesn't make any, whether we're male or woman. It just affects every aspect of our lives, and it began to affect every aspect of our life. God had blessed me with some talent. And on this newspaper, which was then the largest evening newspaper in the world, and I had a city editor who loved me. He really did. He just cared for me a great deal. And he wanted me to really succeed, and he tried in every way he could, because he promoted me from police reporter to covering criminal courts to covering city hall. He found out I could write. He brought me on a nightside rewrite where I was writing the stories for the first edition. Then he brought me on a dayside rewrite where I was writing stories for seven editions, you know, running stories. You know, a fire starts at 8 o'clock in the morning and you're writing about all the people that died at 8 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know. And then when I was 23, I was a byline feature writer for the largest evening newspaper in the world. He was sending me around the country covering big stories. He sent me down to Tuscaloosa, Alabama when George Wallace barred those doors against Arthur Ray Lucy and the blacks. Covered the last execution at Sing Sing Penitentiary, the first time I watched a man die. You know, the last Sputnik shot up in Spain. I mean, big, big stories. And then when I was 25 years old, I was the obituary editor for the Journal American. There's a big difference between those two jobs, by the way. I wound up as the obituary editor because I got fired five times. Five times, all directly as a result of my drinking. All directly as a result. And, I, you know, they fired me when I had that accident. Of course, they said I was drunk on the job, you know. I got fired for cheating on my expense account. I got fired for turning in a phone. I got fired. And by the time I was 25, I had gone from a weekend drunk with the guys and all that to a daily drinker and practically a daily drunk. I drank all the time. Bernard mentioned some of my favorite haunts, you know. Moochie Saloon it was right on the waterfront in New York, you know. And it was a great, great alcoholic saloon. Because when the East River the tide would come in, it would flood the basement, overflow the toilets, and it smelled like home. Not her home. It made me feel at home, you know. If you were an alcoholic like me, you know exactly what I mean. And then I used to hang out at Tootie's. And I get drunk at Tootie's. And Tootie's had a barmaid with a beard, you know. Not as long as yours, but it was a pretty good beard, you know. And I don't know if she had it when I was sober, but she sure had it when I was drinking, you know. And Tootie's. No, what was it? Tootie's, yeah. Well, the barmaid was in Cuckoo's, and in Tootie's, he used to hang stuff all around his joint. And if you could name something that wasn't hanging around his joint, you could drink all night. And Tootie and I were really good friends, and he was an alcoholic. He died of this terrible cirrhosis of the liver. Terrible, terrible, terrible. And as a writer for this paper, I wrote with some of the great, great writers of that of that generation. It was the heyday of journalism. Joe Faulkner, I wrote. I sat right next to Joe on a rewrite desk, and Joe Faulkner was William Faulkner's first cousin. William Faulkner, the writer. And Joe was a better writer than William Faulkner. He was. He was a terrific writer. And the last time I saw Joe was outside of Mucci's Saloon at 2 o'clock in the morning. He was sitting on a curb, vomiting blood into the street, and he died 6 weeks later at Bellevue Hospital of cirrhosis. You know, the guy that Damon Runyon Jr. Damon Runyon, his father, wrote Guys and Dolls and a lot of great books and movies. And Damon Runyon Jr. was trying to live in his father's shadows, and Damon sat on the other side of me, told me a lot about writing, and he was a great writer. But one night he didn't show up, and they called the manager of the apartment, and he went up to his apartment, and they found him dead on the floor, overdose of alcohol and pills. I was sharing my story one night in a rehab in Connecticut, Silver Hill, where Joan Kennedy went and a lot of very wealthy people go, you know. And as I'm talking, there's Truman Capote sitting in the second row, you know. And as far as I'm concerned, Truman was one of the greatest writers this country ever gave birth to. And after I finished, Truman comes up and he says, boy, you had it tough, didn't you? And I said, what the hell are you doing here, Truman? You know? He said, I'm just here for a rest. Yeah. And that summer, they found him dead on Long Island, right? Overdose of alcohol and drugs. We've lost some great writers, great musicians, great actors, great actresses, and great people. This disease kills people. And when we're sitting in a beautiful place like this, on a nice evening like this, with all this love surrounding us, we don't think about that. But there are a lot of people out there that need us, and they're dying. And there are 44 million alcoholics in this country alone, and only 3 million in AA. But we're not doing a very good job. A lot of people out there need us. But I'm not going to get into that today. I'm just here to tell my story. But I tell my group, I said, we can't just come to meetings and sit on our hands and go home and think we've done something. We haven't done anything. We just kept ourselves sober. I mean, if we're not bringing somebody with us to the next meeting, we're not doing anything, you know. If we're not calling the guy who was here last week and isn't here tonight, if we're not calling him to see how he's doing, we're not doing anything. We have a responsibility. I mean, when God gives us this kind of a gift, the gift of life, if we don't go out and try to help save another, this is what God wants us to do. I thought God brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous to be a better husband, to be a better father, you know, to be a better worker, you know, be a successful writer and all this kind of stuff. You know, God, I know now, and I've known for a long time now, that God brings us here for only one reason. He allows us to go through what we've gone through, helps us get sober, helps us find this program, helps us in our sobriety, because he wants us then to help him help another alcoholic. So the only reason we're here is because we have a responsibility to help another alcoholic. That's what this is all about. All about. Well, everything else is, to me, fringe benefits. And I've been overwhelmed by fringe benefits. Overwhelmed. I get embarrassed sometimes when I talk about the fringe benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous. A wife like this, family that I have, 9 kids, 23 grandkids, all kinds of friends all over the country, all over the world. I don't. Somebody said, well, you deserve that. I pray every night. I don't get what I deserve, man. Right? But anyway, I got to the point where I, as I say, it affects every aspect. And I was about to get fired what I do as an obituary editor, I was too busy drinking. So I used to tear the obituaries out of other newspapers, paste them up, and send them into the compose room. This is before computer type, you know, so the old Linotype machines. So we were printing obituaries of guys who died a couple of days ago. You know? I was getting notes in my mailbox in the city room from my city editor saying, we want fresh obits. And I was trying to figure, what the hell is a fresh obit? The guy's dead. He's not fresh, you know. He's not fresh. And anyway, so I've said one. I must have been so drunk, I found this old newspaper, and they printed it in the first edition, and they cut it out after that. But the guy died 5 days ago. He was already buried by the time we printed his obituary. And so I knew I was going to get fired, so I quit. I got a job. A friend of mine had been constantly trying to get me to go with this weekly magazine. So I went with the weekly magazine and spent 3.5 years, you know, interviewing famous people and writing articles, and it was great. Bigger salary, bigger expense account, and bigger drunks. Wherever I went, I got drunk. Missed deadlines, missed any fun. I was about to get fired from that, and I got a job working for a radio station in New York. But when you get to the point where I was, you know, where you can't make a magazine deadline, it's tough to make a radio deadline. You know, you, news at 9:05. Well, I turned my copy in at 9:06. Sorry, you know. And so they fired me. John Scott fired me. And then I got a job working for a small public relations firm, working for this wonderful guy, Abe Schechter. Never forget. In fact, when I finally got sober, Abe and I became good friends. And when he died, his wife asked me to give the talk at his funeral. And anyway, but they fired because what happened? They gave me an office without a window. You should never give a drunk an office without a window, you know? Because I'd come back from my liquid lunches, and I'd close my door, and I'd sit there and breathe for a while. And then somebody would come in to see me, and thank God they didn't let a match. If they'd let a match, boom, you know what those things do, Jack, boom, you know, so. And then they fired me from that, and then I became basically unemployable at the age of 27 in the media in New York. Even in a city of 9 million people, you can get a better reputation, you know. And I had a bad reputation. So, and then it affected our family life. Bernadette, I told you. She didn't tell you when we sold this house in Deer Park, we sold it because I couldn't pay because I was so deeply in debt for my drinking and my drugging and gambling, you know. I wasn't what you call, I don't believe I was, an addicted gambler, but I would gamble hoping to win some money to pay some bills, you know. You know, I'd buy a $5 double daily ticket or daily double ticket on the two longest shots in the race, and then pray to God that they would come in. And then when they didn't, I'd curse God for them not coming in, you know. But in the meantime, I kept my $100 of drinking money, or sometimes $300. Bernadette found, what she found was a fresh loan from local loan company. My drinking money, you know. So things got bad in our relationship and whatnot. She didn't tell you that she found out. In fact, I confessed from up here once that the house in Deer Park, I told her we lost it. I told her we sold it. And I put the money in the bank so we'd buy a house near her mother. I think when you tell so many lies, you can't even remember, right? I remember when I finally sobered up, I said to my sponsor, I'm having trouble remembering things. He says, if you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything, you know. So anyway, we lost the house. The bank took it back from non-payment is what happened, you know. I wasn't a very good husband. I wasn't abusive, I don't believe. But I'm sure I created a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. Now, she told you about that one time that I came home and she asked me where I was, and I told her, don't yell at me because I had a heart attack. Well, I had run fresh out of excuses. You know, after a while, man, most of the time, the truth she wouldn't buy. Most of the time she'd say, where were you? I couldn't remember where the hell I was, you know. I just rolled out of a car, or rolled out of a doorway, or rolled out of something, you know. But this night I figured, the hell with it. So I said I had a heart attack. And she wanted a bill. I mean, why you wives want such detailed nonsense, you know. And so I said, I knew you wouldn't believe me. I'll be right back. So I went all the way back into New York City and over to New York Hospital. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was this little guy in a green suit. What are they called? Resident? Yes, he was a resident doctor. And I pulled him aside and I handed him $20. And I said, you do me a favor and write me a note that I was here last night and had a heart attack. Next thing I know, two big cops are carrying me out onto the street. So anyway, that didn't work. Anyway, but that's the kind of dopey stuff that I used to do. By 1961, I weighed about 320 pounds. I was known in a lot of the bars in New York as the moon. You know, they'd see me, look, walk in, hey, look, the moon is out tonight. You know. And I was a rolling fruitcake is what I was. And so I was sick physically, and I was sick mentally. And spiritually, I had walked away from God. It wasn't that I walked away from God. I just came to believe that God wanted nothing to do with me anymore. You know? We know, right? And one night at a bar, Third Avenue Bar in New York, sawdust on the floor, I came to the conclusion that my problem was I was crazy. And the more I thought about it, the more it made sense. Just think about it. Doesn't being crazy explain what we do? And do it over and over and over again when we don't want to do it the first time? The problem was, then I came home. My wife called me. She said our oldest daughter was sick, had to be taken to the hospital. I met her at the hospital, and I was drunk. On the way home, she said she was hungry, wanted something to eat. And we stopped at a Chinese restaurant. She said I ordered 8 drinks, which I probably did. She helped me put this together. Because I no longer ordered 1 drink at a time, because bartenders are very slow. By the time you finish this one, they're down waiting on other customers, you know, and you're thirsty. So I used to order 2 or 3 at a time, you know, just give them time to get back and forth. She said, I ordered 8. And then she looked at me and she said, Bill, and she did this a couple of times and I hated it. I didn't mind if she screamed and hollered and yelled and whatnot, but she said, look at you, look at you. I was a big, fat, sweaty, stinky drunk. Her hero. Why are you doing this to yourself, she said. Why are you why? Like her mother said to her, why did you elope? Why? Our spouses, the people that love us, they can't understand. We can't understand. I couldn't understand. And she just reached out. Why? And I broke down. I started to cry. Not crocodile tears, you know, which we try to use. But no, I just broke apart. And I said, I think I'm crazy or I'm going crazy. Well, she then, woman of action, called our family doctor. Next thing I know, he told her to make an appointment for me with a psychiatrist. And I went to see a psychiatrist the following Saturday afternoon. But I got ready, you know. You got to get ready for big things in your life, right? I was constantly getting ready for everything I did in my life, you know. So I stopped off at Fred Funk Saloon. I had about 8 shooters, you know, doubles, you know. And I wanted to get really ready because I'm going to lay it all out for this guy, you know. I'm going to tell him the truth. And I remember looking in the mirror, you got to tell this guy the truth. You're going to tell him the truth. You know, I'm going to tell him the truth as I saw the truth. I walk in, he had no couch, and I was immediately disappointed. I thought I'd lay down on the couch and tell him how my father beat me and all that stuff, you know. Instead, he pointed to a chair in front of his desk, and I sat down in the chair. I laid my belly on his desk, you know. He was a little skinny guy with half glasses and a very skinny mustache. And he kept staring at me, you know. And then he said, Bill, right? I said, yeah. Tell me why you're here. He said, you're 27, right? I said, yeah. Tell me why you're here. And I said, because I think I'm crazy. Well, I'm going crazy. He said, well, tell me why. And I began to share some of the things I've talked about, you know, losing jobs and stuff. And then he stopped me and he said to me, you drink a lot, don't you? And it threw me. I didn't know why he asked me that question. You know, I wanted him to talk to me about being crazy and how you stop being crazy. So he threw me a loop here. And I said, I don't know what you mean by a lot, doctor, you know. He said, well, let's take it this way. Do you drink beer on the weekends with your friends? I said, oh, yeah, sure, I drink beer on the weekends with my friends. He said, well, do you ever drink beer on Mondays or Tuesdays? I said, yeah. He said, how about Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays? I said, yeah, sure, why not? He said, well, aside from beer, do you ever drink any, like, rye? I said, yeah, I like rye. Scotch? Oh, yeah, I have a little scotch now and then. And how about vodka? Oh, I like vodka. That's good. Yeah. How about gin? Gin is good, too, you know. Bourbon and water is, whoa, that's really, you know. He said, how about wine? And I remember looking straight up and saying, but I don't drink Christian Brothers Sherry wine. What this guy tried to do was paint a picture of a guy who was 27 years old who drank every day in the week anything he could get his hands on. And then he said to me, do you know what an alcoholic is? And I straightened up again, and I said, I sure do. And I described the guy on the Bowery, sitting on a curb picking lint out of his navel, you know, while sipping out of a bottle in a brown paper bag. And he said, yeah, you're right. He said, that's an alcoholic. But that's an alcoholic in the final stages of his disease. He says, he wasn't born on a curb. He was probably born in a nice place like you. And through the use and abuse of alcohol, he wound up on the Bowery. And then he began to talk to me about the disease of alcoholism. And I suddenly began to get the impression that he was insinuating that I was an alcoholic. And I got teed off. It was like, I can remember like it was yesterday. You know, sometimes we remember when things really hit us. And this hit me. Who the hell does this bum think he is? I kept saying to myself. Here I come to this guy out of the goodness of my heart because I think there's something really wrong with me, and he's now insinuating that I'm a drunk, I'm an alcoholic. I mean, hey, I got a wife and I got kids. And so I stopped listening. The last thing I heard him say was that if you are an alcoholic, I can't help you. And my heart sank because I wanted help. And he said, but I know some people who can. And he handed me a number. It was the Intergroup office of AA in New York. And he said, if you really want help, go see these people. No sense in coming back to me. Then he said, And it costs $25 a visit. This is in 1961. And he says, if you want to keep on drinking, you're going to need the money. He was very straight guy. Now, how do you go home and tell your wife that a psychiatrist thinks you're an alcoholic? It's easy to tell him that he thinks you're a nut, you know. And the only thing I'll share about that conversation, when I looked at Bernadette and I said, he wants me to go to something called AA. And so help me, she looked me back in the eye and she says, how is American Airlines going to help you? You know, that's how much she knew about alcoholics. That's how much I knew about it, you know. I said, not American Airlines. Something about Alcoholics Anonymous, about drinking. Oh, she said, you're going to go, aren't you? So I went over to New York. I walked in. There was this guy named John volunteering that day in the intergroup office. It was about six guys, you know. And he stood up. He had to be 6 foot six, 6 foot eight. Maybe he was only 6'2", but in my eyes, he was a big guy. And he stuck out his hand. You know the people that help us, right? I thought he had a catcher's mitt on his hand. It was that big. And he said to me, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. You got a problem with alcohol? I said, no, John, not me. I said, but there's a psychiatrist back in Queens that thinks I do. And he sent me over here for some information. He said, you want some information? I was half loaded. Yeah, I want some information, John. So he says, I'll tell you what, I'll take you to an AA meeting tonight, and you get all the information you want. I said, what's tonight? Tonight's Saturday? I'm busy tonight, John. I had nothing to do with drink, you know. And he said, then God, he's this God of ours is, he's always there, isn't he? He's always there waiting for us to be ready, waiting for us to ask, waiting for us to be accepted. He's always there. And there he was again, because John stood up, said, if you can't make it tonight, I'll tell you what. He reached into his jacket and he pulled out his business card and he handed it to me. And he said, anytime you want to go to a meeting, just give me a call. I said, thank you, John. So I grabbed his card. And I started to walk out. I got close to the door and I looked at his card and it said, John So-and-so, Vice President, Chase Manhattan Bank. And I was running short, you know. And I remember thinking, I already get to know this guy. We're great manipulators, right? So I walked back to the desk. I said, you know, John, I could probably change my plans and make it tonight. And that's how God got me to my first AA meeting. God does it all for us. Yeah. So, but it didn't take. After the meeting, they gather around us. You know, we're terrible, the newcomers. And with that meeting list, you got to get it in their hands or stick it somewhere, you know. And they told me that your home group meets on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I couldn't tell them. I couldn't go to my home group. I didn't want anybody to see me going anywhere near Alcoholics Anonymous. I never used to stop. I didn't stop for a moment to think that, you know, Saturday afternoons, they used to see me urinating on their hedges, you know, but to see me going to AA, so. So I'm 3 miles out of my way and went to the Woodhaven group, and I stayed around 3 months, almost 3 months. And I didn't drink that much. I wanted to give it a good shot. That's the way we drunks think, Jack. And then I came home and I sat down on the cot next to Bernadette's behind the oil burner. And I remember saying to her, I'm glad I went to AA. Because if I ever kept on drinking, I learned something, I said. I learned if I ever kept drinking the way I was drinking, someday I could have a lot of trouble. I'm unemployable. I'm sleeping on a cot behind an oil burner, right? I got no money. And I got the DA of Brooklyn and the DA of Queens looking for me on bad check charges, and I owed $62,000 from banks to banks and finance companies. But that's how sick I was. She said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm just going to drink beer. And I did for partially that night, and then all of a sudden, boom. And that was in March of 1961. First week of April of 1962, I was on a window ledge of the Margarita Hotel on East 21st Street in New York, about to jump. At 28, my life was over. I had nothing else left to live for. I knew without a shadow of a doubt there was no way to get out of this. You know? No way. That feeling of hopelessness and despair, you know, it had me like that. And for some reason or other, I just didn't even think about it. I crawled back in. And I said, I'm better off leaving her. And so I came home. I told Bernie I was going to leave. And instead of screaming and hollering, she just looked at me and she said to me, before you leave, do you think you owe me one last favor? I said, I guess so. And she said, Bill, for God's sakes, why don't you give AA another try? That's from a woman who I thought hated my guts. But I couldn't handle it. So I ran out of the house. I went down two blocks to a bar, ran in and ordered two double shots. Got one down. I had the other one in my hand like that. I looked in the mirror and I knew I could not go any further. I just couldn't go any further. So I put it down and I went back home. I took a shower in my mother-in-law's apartment. When I came out, the phone was ringing. She had called somebody. A guy named Joe, and Joe had called me back, and he said to me very, very simply, Bill, would you like to give AA another try? And I said, Joe, please. Yes. Yes. And that was God answering for me. And that was April 7th, because the following day, April 8th of 1962, they brought me back to the Woodhaven Group, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since. But I wanted to drink, like I said, more than I wanted to breathe. Oh, God, did I want to drink. Every time I thought, you know, those fears, that panic, you know, I hadn't filed an income tax in 11 years. I knew the next knock on the door was the federal agents hauling me off to prison, you know. I mean, that kind of stuff that I had, it's all piled up, you know. And I used to walk around corners when I thought somebody was following me. I was afraid to answer the telephone. I'd never look at the mail. I'd turn it upside down. And then a month later, I'd look at the very bottom, and if I hadn't heard from them, I'd throw that away. That's how I handle all the bills and all the notices. Sick, scared, panicked, alcoholic. But Benny, this Jewish jeweler from Brooklyn who I had met the year before, didn't remember him. He remembered me. He just shook my hand and he said, Bill, if you don't drink, you got a chance. And I remember sitting on that window ledge thinking I didn't have a chance. And he said to me, if you don't drink, you got a chance. And he says, I'll show you, and we'll show you how to not drink. But you can't just not drink. You got to change. And we'll show you how to change, too. And he became my sponsor. He brought me into the kitchen of the Woodhaven Group. Back in those days, we drank coffee out of mugs, you know, so you had to wash them. You can't stay sober washing these damn styrofoam cups, you know. Back then, we smoked a lot, right? And most of us, anyway. So you had to wash the ashtrays, wash the knives and forks, wash the dishes, mop the floors, you know. And he got me into that right away. He knew how bad I was, and he knew how bad I needed to be out of me. And you get out of you by being in service, like my friend over there. And so he got me into it right away. And when I had my hands in that hot soapy water washing that stuff, something happened. And I'm not being melodramatic. I love to be melodramatic, but I'm not. I began to feel different. I did not know what was going on. We don't know in the beginning what's going on. But I was already beginning to change because I was in service. I was doing something for somebody else, and I was forgetting about me. I was thinking stupid, egotistical things like, I bet they think I'm a wonderful guy washing their damn dishes, you know. That kind of stuff, ego stuff. But it got me by. I mean, it kept me washing the dishes, you know. And then gradually I came to understand that this was the right thing to do, you know. We have to act ourselves into thinking right. We can't think ourselves into acting right. I heard that from my sponsor time and time again. And then Benny took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My life began to change. When I finally got to that third step, which Bernadette also had a problem with, I had a problem with it because I thought God didn't want anything to do with me. And it was very difficult. And my Jewish sponsor took me to a Matt Talbot Catholic AA retreat in a Catholic monastery, of all places. And that's where I did the third step. I turned my will and my life over to Benny's God because Benny had a loving God in his life who he talked about all the time, how much God loved him, how much God took care of this, how much God takes care of this. I still have Benny's God. I haven't had Benny now for some reason. He was my sponsor for the first 31 years of my sobriety, but he's still in my life. He will always be in my life. The people that have helped us will never leave us. People in AA don't die. You know, they don't die. And so I began to grow up, like Bernadette said. Moved to Nashville. I became a husband, I became a father, and I was very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. Moved to Cleveland, Ohio, right next to the birthplace of AA. And then some gentlemen in Cleveland saw something happen. Now, they were not in AA, but they saw how hard I worked and the things that I did and whatnot. And they put some money together, and they financed me in the communications business back in New York. And I moved back to New York. It was the year after year Mama died. And I came back to New York, and we had 8 children then. We had our 9th back in New York. And I got very, very busy. And I was representing a lot of different corporations. And I was staying active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I met an investment banker. We became good friends. And he was putting a new company together, an independent motion picture production company. And he invited me to meet the 3 partners. He thought I might be a good fit since I was a good writer. And I knew a lot about show business from Nashville and so forth. And I met these 3 guys, and I joined their company, and we formed a company called Arliss Entertainment Complex, and we began to make movies. And just to brag a little bit, we made a movie called Kansas City Bomber. It starred Raquel Welch as a roller derby queen. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine being on a set and watching Raquel Welch back then skating around the rink in these black, tight-fitting leather pants? It was like having a spiritual experience. And so I fell in love with the business. You know, why not? And then a friend of mine, whom I had covered the Knapp Commission with, which was an investigation of dirty cops in New York, And the undercover cop was a fellow named Frank Serbico, and they tried to kill him a couple of times, and so he fled to Sweden. And Peter Moss, who was, he had worked for the Herald Tribune, and I worked for the Journal. Peter's a wonderful, you might have read some of his books. He's a wonderful writer. He got Frank's rights and was writing a book called Serbico, and we had our company. And so I said to Peter, why don't we do it together? I said, why don't we make the movie? And he says, okay, can you get the money? So we got Dino De Laurentiis, who was still alive then, and he put up the money, and we got Al Pacino. And he had just done his first movie called Panic in Needle Park, which was a great drug movie. And we got Al to play Serbico, and that put us on the map. And then another partner and I came in one day with a tear sheet from Life magazine about a young man in Brooklyn who had just robbed a bank to get his lover a sex change operation. And from that $15,000 buy from Life magazine, we made a movie called Dog Day Afternoon, which turned out to be a pretty good flick. And then by this time, Bernadette had met Lois Wilson and was going up to her house regularly. And she invited me up one day to meet with Lois. It was a Saturday. And I was kind of busy, but I said, I'll go along anyway. So I went. And thank God I did, because I met the most incredible lady you'd ever want to meet. And I mean that. I mean, there was something inside of Lois. Outside, she was at that time probably early 80s, because you knew her for about 15 years, and she died at 97. But inside was a dynamo, a brilliant, brilliant woman. And we became fast friends. She transferred her love and confidence in Bernadette to me, even though I was on an ego trip, because I was going to now make, because I had seen the upstairs of her house, right, Jack, with all those pictures of all the newcomers, I mean, the people that started AA and the people that started Al-Anon. It was like a museum, veritable museum up there. So I came down and asked her if I could do a movie about her and her husband and how AA started. And she was kind of surprised that I was so blunt, but she turned to Bernie and she said, can your husband write? And then she turned to me, and when Bernadette assured her I could, and she said, well, let's give it time. She didn't rush into things. You know, I did, but she didn't, because she was not an alcoholic. You know, we like to get things done in a day that takes 16 eons, you know. And so she said, let's get together. And I began to go up there on a regular basis with a tape recorder. And the more we talked, and the more, and Bernadette and I would take her out to dinner. And I got to share this quick story. The first night we took her out to dinner, we went to her and Bill's favorite French restaurant in Westchester County. And we sat down, and she's kind of nervous. And I didn't know whether she was nervous because it was the first time we were having dinner together. But Bernadette and she had lunch many times. And she leaned over to me and she said, I hope you don't mind, but Bill would always insist that I have a drink before a meal. I said, it's fine with me. Oh, okay, fine. So she had two, right? So it was wonderful, wonderful. She shared her whole life with me. And it was a result of that that I wrote a script. And I won't go into the long details of how all of that happened because I'm running out of time. But I did wind up meeting a fellow named Peter DeShow out in California, who was James Garner's partner, and they had been trying to make a movie about AA. And so we got together, and Peter and I and Jim Garner, and we cut a deal, and I rewrote my script for television, and that's how My Name is Bill W. Came to be. And it was on ABC, April 30th of 1989. I had wished Lois lived to see it, but she died October 5th of 1988. But 4 months before she died, I had finished the first draft, and I brought it up to her, and we made a date. And I brought it up to her again. It was on a Saturday afternoon. We sat out on the back porch, the screened-in porch out in the back, and I read her the script. It took 3 hours. Yeah, there were four pee breaks, three for her, one for me. And when we got all finished, both of us were crying. And she said, Bill would love this. For Lois, it was always Bill. It was her whole life. She told me so many times I was addicted to Bill as much as he was addicted to alcohol, you know. And that's true, isn't it, in Al-Anon, you know. But she'd also say that Bill often say, and Dr. Bob, when they would visit, Bill and Bob would say, how God gave us such wonderful women, I don't know. And I do believe that as much as we give Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob credit for founding Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe the real credit, and this is from my research in doing books and movies about the subject, I believe the real credit belongs to Lois and Ann, Lois Wilson and Annie Smith. And I'll tell you why, very quickly. When Bill was leaving for Akron to go down on that a project for the banks, he was very upset, very angry with himself because he considered himself a total failure. He had been bringing drunks to the house, bringing them from Towns Hospital, bringing them from Bellevue Hospital, and none of them got sober, none of them. And he told Lois that day, and Lois shared this with me, that he was a total failure. Nothing he wanted to accomplish ever came to be. And even he couldn't help get any of these drunks sober. Nobody stayed sober, and Lois looked at him and said, but you did. And maybe it was by working with those drunks that kept you sober. And Bill took that thought with him to Akron, Ohio. And so that day, the day before Mother's Day, when he was marching back and forth in the Mayflower Hotel, wanting to drink, he wanted to drink that day, because he was, again, a complete failure. The thought hit him about what Lois said, that working with other drunks kept him sober. And so he ran into the phone booth, and he started calling ministers and priests, asking them if they could help him find a drunk in Akron. And they thought he was nuts until he came across the minister, Reverend Tunks, who knew Henrietta Seibeling, and put Bill together with Henrietta, and Henrietta put Bill together with Dr. Bob through Annie Smith. Dr. Bob did not want to leave the house that Mother's Day. He had a heck of a hangover. Smitty, his son, who I interviewed many, many times, and we became very good friends, told me that his dad didn't want to leave the house that day. He had a big headache. But Annie insisted, we're going. I don't care how you feel. We're going. And she dragged his behind over there to meet with this New York guy. And on the way, he said, I'm going to stay for 15 minutes. That's it. And they spent 3.5 hours together. But Annie got him there, and Lois got Bill there. And that's why I believe we owe them a big debt of gratitude. And finally, I'll close by sharing this, that 2001, Bernard and I moved from New York to South Carolina, built a new house. I was unpacking boxes in my new study, and I came across a stack of old tapes. And those were the tapes that I made of Lois Wilson, all those interviews, 10.5 hours. And I put one in the deck, and out comes Lois's voice, and in comes Bernadette. Shoo, you know? That's Lois. No, it's Lois. Where'd you find those tapes? I said, they were in the box, you know? And she says, what are you going to do with them? I said, I don't know. She says, you got to do something with them. I said, yeah, but you got to do something with them. You know how wives are. And I said, Well, I knew. I knew almost immediately when I heard Lois's voice that she had given me so much of her life and Bill's life for the movie My Name is Bill W., where I was able to say, talk a lot, show a lot about Bill, but very little about Lois. I had written three scenes about Al-Anon, but the movie could only run 98 minutes, and so these ran over, so they cut the three scenes. So there's nothing in there about Lois and Al-Anon. So I owed her a great debt. So that's when I just sat down and I wrote a book, The Lois Wilson Story, When Love Is Not Enough. And when the book came out, I got a call from Hallmark Hall of Fame, Brad Moore, president of Hallmark Hall of Fame, and he says, why didn't you tell me about this? I said, well, we would have gotten around to sending you a copy. He says, well, I got it from the Internet, and he said, I read it and I loved it. He says, you believe lightning can strike twice in the same place? I said, I guess so. He said, well, let's make this one too. And it took 3 years, a lot of trouble, ups and downs. Some people didn't understand Al-Anon. I didn't understand it as much as you do, but we finally worked things out. And then we got Winona Ryder, who was a marvelous actress who wanted to play the role in the worst way because she has an addiction problem that the 12 steps have helped, plus a lot of friends in Al-Anon, and she had been living with a guy who needed AA. And then we got a director whose mother died in his lap of alcoholism. And we got Barry Pepper, fabulous, fabulous young actor. And he is incredible. In fact, one night we were shooting a scene where he's in Towns Hospital shivering. And he said to the director, he says, if I lay on this bed and shiver, I'm just pretending I'm shivering, it's going to look in the movie like I'm pretending I'm shivering. So John said to him, what do you want to do, Barry? He says, well, can you send some of the crew out for some ice and pack me an ice? And then when I really start to shiver, shoot. He's what you call a method actor. Seriously. And he laid on that bed, packed with bags of ice. And when he finally said, shoot, they said, roll him. And when you see that movie and you see him shivering, man, he is freezing to death, freezing to death. So God has really blessed me. One last thing. I never forget when I was on a book tour, I was in Chicago. Chicago, Bill. Chicago. And had a book signing. And there was a man in the audience, and he said to me, you're talking about this Lois Wilson, and you're saying that you interviewed her all these times and whatnot. Did she always tell you? Did she also always answer your questions? I said, yeah, absolutely. She answered all of my questions. Really? I said, yeah. I said, but sometimes she would answer them in her own way, you know. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, for example, one day we were sitting in her living room, and we got on the subject of sex and how Bill, when he would get really bad, you know, and he's really long drunks, he would wind up impotent, you know. And that's how we got on the subject. And I said to Lois, what was it like when Bill would come home stinky, filthy, dirty, sweaty, drunk, and crawl into bed with you and want to make love? And she looked at me and she smiled and she said, ask your wife. And so I was able to write about it, you know. So that's how. So thank you for letting me share those. And I never used to, but I share them today because Peter DeShaw, who was the executive producer of Bill W., said to me one day, he said, do you tell people what we've done? And I said, no. He said, oh, you want people to think you're a nice, humble guy, you know. And I said, I guess so. He says, stop being the phony. He said, if you're willing to tell them all the garbage in your life, why don't you tell them some of the good stuff that God has given you in your life? And isn't that true? We're so willing to share all the crap, you know. But why are we willing to share some of the gifts that we've been given? you know, a new grandchild, a new baby, a new husband, you know, new car. I mean, all the wonderful, thunderful things, they don't have to be material, they can be spiritual, you know. And so that's why I don't hesitate anymore sharing it, because I know where they come from, you know. It wasn't Bill. I was simply, and that's not phony either, I'm simply like you and I are. We are instruments for God to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. That's why he gives us the talents and the gifts to us to use for him. Sober. And that's what it's all. And my mother-in-law, Bernadette's mother, knew that. For some reason or other, she was such a spiritual person. And don't forget, our solution is a spiritual solution. If we don't have a good spiritual condition, we can't stay sober. And Mama was a spiritual person, and she knew I was spiritually ill. And that's why, even though she saw what I was doing to my wife and her children and her grandchildren, she didn't say anything. She just prayed for me. I get sober. We move to Nashville. We're having another child. We had Robert. And Mama, I flew Mama down to take care of Bernadette and the kids, because Mama loves taking care of kids, you know, babies. And one night, Bernadette's in bed, the kids are all in bed, and I go into the den to do some writing, and Mama's heading for the dining room to do some praying, you know. And she notices me in the den, and she comes in, and she sits down next to me on the couch. Mama was only a little thing, you know. And she puts a paraphernalia down on her lap, you know. And she looks up at me, and she says, "You know, Bill," she says, "all of my life, I've been reading about in the New Testament all the miracles that Jesus performed. And then I read in the lives of the saints all the miracles that the saints performed." And she said, "I've often wondered what it would be like to see a real miracle." And then she put her hand on my shoulder. And she said, "And now I have." She saw the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life before I did, you know. And that's what we are, all of us. Were miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you for letting me share that. Thank you.